Blog Talk Radio.
Friends, you're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist. You can find us online at speculist.com. That's S-P-E-C-U-L-I-S-T.com. Or go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we are all about a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities, which are at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world is changing in ways that are difficult to predict, sometimes even difficult to imagine. And Fast Forward Radio is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead and that will be here sooner than you think. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
Well, I'm super fantastic. How are you, my friend?
I'm doing great. Doing great. Had a good week this week. Hope you have, too.
Well, I have. I just spent 2 days in Florida, and it was an interesting kind of a transition there and back again. I left early Monday morning as a snowstorm was moving into Denver. Actually, we had this, like, just really nasty icy fog descending over my part of town as I was driving to the airport. It was a big, long flight. It was like one of these I had to transferred through Charlotte, North Carolina, so took a good chunk out of the day getting there. But I got to Fort Lauderdale in the mid-afternoon, and it's sunny and 78 degrees. I'm like, well, you know, that's a nice transition to make. That works really well for me. Yesterday morning, got up 72 degrees, sunny, beautiful. We drove down from Fort Lauderdale. We had another meeting. It was closer to Miami. Just this beautiful drive and just this really nice location we were in, just perfect weather, perfect day. Flew back home to Denver, and the Arctic air mass had moved in, and it was minus 13 degrees when I got home last night. So,
man,
kind of a shocker. Yeah.
Well, I mean, you know, down here in Louisiana, we were down in the teens last night, and
wow.
Yeah, that's about as cold as it ever gets here in Louisiana. My kids put out a full bucket out in the backyard, full of water. And, you know, it had all kinds of things floating in it and everything, leaves and things like that. Well, got up this morning and it was frozen solid, and they were very impressed by that. You know, I mean, it doesn't take much for kids that never see freezing weather to be impressed, you know.
Yeah, that's pretty good. For the whole bucket of water. Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They dumped it out in the driveway and just played with it and kicked up the ice. The big thing of ice around. It was kind of funny. But you're right. Yeah, it doesn't take much.
Well, I'll tell you, it's an experience like that. That's one of those things that makes me think maybe Sally's got the right idea here. Perhaps people weren't meant to live certain places in the winter. I mean, you know, it's great to ski and all those kinds of things. But 13 below is just... You know, I mean, it's cold when it's in the teens, and I know that in your part of the world it's very cold because of the humidity. But once you get down there below zero Fahrenheit, and a guy was telling me as we were getting on the plane that he had a friend at the Air Force Academy who had called him, and that day it had gotten down to 40 below there, because you know they're up about halfway up Pikes Peak by the time you get to the Air Force Academy, and 40 below is a very special temperature. Do you know why, Stephen?
I have no idea. I just know it's very. I've experienced it, and I know it's very, very, very cold. I mean, you don't. It's a whole new level of cold. But anyway,
well, I don't know if you're prepared for this, but we could actually do this as an astounding science fact.
Okay. Well, let's see if I am. Okay. While you're talking, I'm going to just see if we're ready for. Here we go. There we go.
Astounding science facts.
Now, Now, in the time it took to play that, I've had someone in the chat room who said what the amazing thing about 40 below Fahrenheit is. And unfortunately, I don't have chat room access tonight. So has anyone blown the surprise?
Go ahead. I don't think anybody knows.
Okay. So 40 below is the same in Fahrenheit and Celsius.
Oh, okay. It's where the two things cross. Okay.
The intersection of Fahrenheit and Celsius. So when it's 40 below, you don't have to specify which of the two systems you're talking about. The temperature is accurate in either system.
Like the stop clock, it's right. You know,
it's right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. This is 40 below is where they both agree. It's freaking cold. Okay.
Yeah.
It's ridiculously cold. Now, when did you ever experience 40 below?
It was actually at Angel Fire, New Mexico. We were there at Christmas time. That's probably been 25, 30 years ago. And, you know, we saw this snow storm coming in, which is really beautiful. You know, I mean, particularly for people that don't experience a lot of snow. You know, this huge blizzard whiteout just, you know, marching towards you. And then it got down to 40 below. And it was extremely, extremely cold. It was too cold to ski. They did not bother to open the mountain, you know, that day. So,
yeah, I mean, that is just painful. I mean, any exposed flesh is going to be in pain, I would think, at that temperature.
Yeah. And anything, and even if you're not exposed, you're still, I mean, it's hard to ski when for shivering. I mean, it's just, you know, you're almost convulsing. It's so cold.
It's not fit for being outside. Kind of a bonus astounding science fact for this.
Yeah, there you go. Oh, and another thing about 40 below is you can hear your breath freeze when you breathe out. Not only do you see the cloud of, you know, that goes out in front of you like you would at, say, 20 degrees, but at 40 below, you can actually, if you listen close, it's like a snap, crackle, pop going on in the atmosphere right in front of you. So
that's amazing. Wow.
That's pretty cool. Okay, so there's another bonus astounding science fact. So
another bonus astounding science fact. Well, it occurred to me that my weather travails here actually provided kind of an interesting segue into our first topic tonight, which we want to talk a little bit about the anniversary of the Space Shuttle Challenger disaster, which occurred 25 years ago, Thursday, I think it was January 28th, and whatever day of the week that was. But January 28th, 1986, Space Shuttle Challenger essentially exploded, 90-some seconds into its flight, killing all seven astronauts on board. And this, interestingly, occurred almost to the day, 19 years after Apollo 1, where astronauts Gus Grissom, astronauts White and Chaffee were killed in the fire that occurred on that capsule. So it's kind of an ominous time of the year, and obviously a sad set of anniversaries back to back. But I thought it was worth noting that had occurred, and the cause of the Space Shuttle Challenger disaster, you know, was speaking of the weather in Florida, you know, Cape Canaveral's up there closer to the north end of Florida, I guess geographically a little closer to where you are in Louisiana, and the weather, you know, the temperature does get cold sometimes. And it was actually freezing temperatures that caused that O-ring not to seat properly, not to seal, which led to the disaster. So there, in a sense, oddly enough, the weather, that although there are a number of other factors we can get into, but the weather kind of ultimately was the cause of that great disaster.
Yeah, it was something about the O-rings being brittle and then failing. And simply because it had frozen, which even in that part of Florida was a very, very rare thing. And so, you know, it's one of those things sometimes you don't know all the risks until you do different things. And so this is probably one of the first flights you know, in that kind of weather as far as the from Florida. So, you know, and unfortunately, it was a disaster resulted. So, you know, we tonight we have an audio clip of President Reagan comforting the nation after that disaster.
Why don't we play that?
Okay. Well, it doesn't seem to be playing.
Oh.
Well, okay.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'd planned to speak to you tonight to report on the State of the Union. But the events of earlier today have led me to change those plans. Today is a day for mourning and remembering. Nancy and I are pained to the core by the tragedy of the Shuttle Challenger. We know we share this pain with all of the people of our country. This is truly a national loss. 19 years ago, almost to the day, we lost three astronauts in a terrible accident on the ground. But we've never lost an astronaut in flight. We've never had a tragedy like this. And perhaps we've forgotten the courage it took for the crew of the shuttle. But they, the Challenger 7, were aware of the dangers, but overcame them and did their jobs brilliantly. We mourn seven heroes: Michael Smith, Dick Scobie, Judith Resnick, Ronald McNair, Ellison Onizuka, Gregory Jarvis, and Krista Mikulov. We mourn their loss as a nation together. The families of the seven, we cannot bear, as you do, the full impact of this tragedy. But we feel the loss, and we're thinking about you so very much. Your loved ones were daring and brave, and they had that special grace, that special spirit that says, "Give me a challenge, and I'll meet it with joy." They had a hunger to explore the universe and discover its truths. They wished to serve, and they did. They served all of us. We've grown used to wonders in this century. It's hard to dazzle us. But for 25 years, the United States space program has been doing just that. We've grown used to the idea of space, and perhaps we forget that we've only just begun. We're still pioneers. They, the members of the Challenger crew, were pioneers. And I want to say something to the school children of America who were watching the live coverage of the shuttle's takeoff. I know it's hard to understand, but sometimes painful things like this happen. It's all part of the process of exploration and discovery. It's all part of taking a chance and expanding man's horizons. The future doesn't belong to the faint-hearted. It belongs to the brave. The Challenger crew was pulling us into the future, and we'll continue to follow them. I've always had great faith in and respect for our space program, and what happened today does nothing to diminish it. We don't hide our space program. We don't keep secrets and cover things up. We do it all up front and in public. That's the way freedom is, and we wouldn't change it for a minute. We'll continue our quest in space. There will be more shuttle flights and more shuttle crews, and yes, more volunteers, more civilians, more teachers in space. Nothing ends here. Our hopes and our journeys continue. I want to add that I wish I could talk to every man and woman who works for NASA or who worked on this mission and tell them, your dedication and professionalism have moved and impressed us for decades, and we know of your anguish. We share it. There's a coincidence today. On this day, 390 years ago, the great explorer Sir Francis Drake died aboard ship off the coast of Panama. In his lifetime, the great frontiers were the oceans, and a historian later said he lived by the sea, died on it, and was buried in it. Well, today, we can say of the Challenger crew, their dedication was, like Drake's, complete. The crew of the Space Shuttle Challenger honored us for the manner in which they lived their lives. We will never forget them, nor the last time we saw them, this morning, as they prepared for their journey and waved goodbye and slipped the surly bonds of Earth to touch the face of God. Thank you.
So there's President Reagan quoted from the poem High Flight by John McGee. The famous last line of that: put out my hand and touch the face of God. honoring the Space Shuttle Challenger astronauts. And, you know, when I mentioned Apollo 3, it occurred to me when the president was talking, he said there will be more missions, more flights, more volunteers, and ultimately, of course, there were more tragedies. And it was only yesterday that was the 8th anniversary of the Space Shuttle Columbia tragedy when 7 more astronauts were lost under completely different circumstances, this time on reentry, and more discoveries made about problems with the, in this case, not the rocket system, but the actual space shuttle design itself that had to be improved. Well, you know, getting back to the temperature issue, I actually, when working on my master's degree, it was not a thesis, but it was a similar paper to a thesis. My final paper for my master's degree was on the report of the Rogers Commission, the presidential commission that investigated the Space Shuttle Challenger disaster. And it's a very interesting story that unfolds there. But one of the most dramatic moments in those hearings of that commission, and I don't know, Steve, if you've ever seen this this clip on YouTube, Richard Feynman was on the panel. He was one of the members of the commission, and they were talking about the possibility of, you know, what had occurred there with the O-rings. And he just happens to be sitting here holding a piece of the plastic that those O-rings are made of, and it's very malleable. It's very rubber-like, and I don't know if you've ever seen this, but he just drops it into a glass of ice water in front of him. And then when he lifts it back out, it's just clearly it's this hard and brittle substance suddenly. It's just a very dramatic demonstration of what had occurred and what the NASA engineers had failed to foresee. And, you know, it occurs to me that we're starting out on this kind of bleak note tonight, but this is actually a good follow-up to our discussion last week. This ultimately is the price you pay if you have not looked at the bleak scenarios, right? If you have not prepared yourself for the potential disasters that can come.
Well, you know, even after 9/11, you know, one of the big things that came out of the commission that investigated it was that it was a failure of imagination.
That's right.
On the part of our intelligence agencies to, you know, to fail to imagine that somebody might hijack an airplane and then fly it into a building. That's what, and if we had thought about that and considered that risk, we would have, you know, things would have been different, at least as far, you know, as our efforts to prevent it. And so, you know, I think it's important to sometimes bum yourself out a little bit to consider, you know, the worst things that could possibly happen so that you don't have to go through it, you know. It's sort of a bummer topic, especially leading into the guest audio we have tonight. But, oh, well.
Well, it provides a nice transition. I mean, we can make this abrupt transition now. We can assure our audience that we're not going to spend 2 entire programs on bleak scenarios. But it seemed appropriate to mention the 25th anniversary of Challenger, the day certainly that I remember very well, as I do the day that the Columbia disaster occurred. And you know, I think you make a really good point about the failure of imagination. It seems like we had a show a while back where we were talking about the fact that you can't improve things that you can't measure. And, you know, the counterpoint to that is you can't prevent things that you can't imagine, right? If they're not in your radar, you're not going to be able to keep them from happening. So with that in mind, we will close out now the bleak scenario discussion for the time being. We will return to it at some point. But let's talk a little bit about our guest this evening. I should note this is our live show, but we've got quite a bit of pre-recorded material this evening, so it's kind of a... This is kind of an easy week for us, but tell us about your chat with Brian Mallow.
Well, you know, he's been on the show before, and you know, like any good entertainer, he left us wanting more, it was a pleasure to get back in touch with him and to have him back on the show. He's a fun guy. I mean, he's a funny guy. He's good at humor. But he's also extremely knowledgeable about, you know, the stuff that we like to talk about. So, you know, it's he easily moves between the world of funny and the world of science. And so I found it fun company because, you know, frankly, that's kind of what we do every week. We kind of we talk about serious things, but have a few laughs while we're doing it. So
we give it our best. Absolutely,
that's right. We do our best. We're you know, we're not pros at it like this guy, but you know, he's our kind of guy. You know, I mean, we're kindred spirits with Brian Mallow. So with that being said, I guess we can go ahead and launch into his interview.
Let's do it.
This is Stephen Gordon, and I have with me today a very special guest, Brian Mallow. Brian, am I pronouncing your last correctly?
No, not really, but...
Why don't you help me out here? How do you pronounce your last name?
It's Mallow. If there were two L's, it would be easy. No one would miss it.
Okay. All right. Well, I'll pronounce it as if they're two L's. Brian Mallow is the self-proclaimed premier science comedian for the planet Earth. Based in San Francisco, Brian performs for science organizations, corporations, science festivals, universities, and special events. He is available for off-world appearances if transportation is provided. He's been featured on The Late Late Show with Craig Ferguson and in Nature, the San Francisco Chronicle, the Washington Post, and the New York Times. He is a freelance science correspondent for Time Magazine's website. Even more importantly, he has been a prior guest on the self-proclaimed world premier science podcast, Fast Forward Radio. So, Brian, it's an honor to have you back on the show. Welcome back.
It's great to be here.
You left us wanting more last
physical
time.
It's great to be here where I sit every day of my life in front of my desk.
That's right. We can speak virtually, though, and that's cool enough, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, tell me a little bit about what's going on with you these days. I understand that you got a big date coming up here soon at the Punchline Comedy Club.
Yeah, I have a show that's coming up. How long is that now? Just for more than a week, February 9th, Wednesday, here in San Francisco, Punchline Comedy Club. And that will be a lot of fun, I think. A bunch of new material that I'm working out. But in the meantime, I have so much to do before that. Tomorrow I'm headed to a conference about synthetic biology.
Okay.
And that's, you know, like genetic engineering and we're moving into an area where the tools to do some kinds of genetic engineering, well, a lot of people think that it's going to be the next revolution, like the computer revolution, and that just like the home computing revolution, that ultimately, when we flash forward just a little, the ability to tinker with the genetic code isn't going to be that much different from tinkering with, you know, computer code.
Well, we've been kind of keeping up with some of this. We understand Craig Venter is actually trying to take, like, the very basic building blocks that are, you know, something that's not life and putting them together and, you know, kick-starting it, and you got life there. I guess that's part of the synthetic biology field as well. There's been some exciting stuff going on with that.
Yeah, I'm actually working on a video right now. I'm going to this conference, and one of the things I'm going to do is present a short video that's about the Hollywood perception of synthetic biology or genetic engineering. And the conference is great. It's a combination of scientists and, I guess, politicians. And there's some science fiction writers there as well. So a bunch of really remarkable people. And Neal Stephenson and Robert J. Sawyer are a couple of the writers. Also Bruce Sterling. And, it's being held at the Google offices in Washington, D.C. And sponsored by
awesome.
Slate and the New America Foundation and Arizona State University. And, and I'm going to also speak briefly, and I'm also going to have a chat with the Canadian science fiction writer Robert J. Sawyer, a friend of mine, about we're going to play my video, and then we're going to talk about the Hollywood perception of this stuff, which, you know, for the most part, it's the Frankenstein story.
Well, yeah, and you know, I'm sure it makes for a much more interesting movie, you know, The Blob does than what is probably closer to reality. I mean, what's your take on where we're at in synthetic biology? I mean, do we need to be concerned, or is the promise a whole lot more important to us at this point?
You know, that's the question, and you know, I'm no expert on this subject. I'm just a comedian, but I don't know it up, and it'll be interesting. I'll see what I learn over the next couple of days. But you know, it seems like it's awesome power, and I don't know if we know what the consequences would be. And I don't know, maybe there are. I mean, I think some people are moving forward thinking they're thinking about the consequences, frankly. But I just heard that in Malaysia there was a release of like 6,000 genetically engineered mosquitoes. And the idea is they've been engineered, they're all male, and they've been engineered to produce sterile offspring.
Okay,
and
all right.
The idea is like this is like they're like towards combating, it was sort of an experiment, but it's towards combating dengue fever. But this really just sounds like the plot of, as I say this in my video, it does sound like the premise of every science fiction horror film on this subject, that you know, oh, it's okay because they're sterile and nothing's going to happen and they're not going to live long, and then you release them into the wild and something goes wrong.
Wasn't that the exact plot of Jurassic Park? I've seen this before, you know? I mean,
exactly.
Bad things happen. Yeah.
You know, to work on this video, I watched a handful of movies, and it's the plot of all of them. It's Jurassic Park, and it's Mimic is another one. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, you know, it's huge power, and of course, with power, you need to, you know, what Spider-Man teaches, you know, with power comes responsibility, right? But you know, also the promise of, you know, perhaps getting better at making enough food for everybody, and maybe enough fuel to drive around. You know, it's a huge
the promise. Is amazing. Yes, you know, like one of the things Ventures are interested in, I think, is engineering bacteria or microorganisms to create fuels or to break down oil spills. Pretty interesting possibilities. And that's really just taking abilities that do exist genetically somewhere and understanding that and then using it. And it's like borrowing biological technology and applying it where we need it.
Awesome, awesome. Well, and so what scientists are you expecting to hear at this conference? That they've been published a lot lately? I mean, who else
I'm not sure, but there is but I happened to watch a debate between two guys. The Long Now Foundation put out a debate between two guys, Drew Endy and Jim Thomas. And Drew Endy is one of the big synthetic bio guys. He's I can't tell you a whole lot. I think that if we did this interview after the conference, I could probably tell you a lot more. But the other guy, Jim Thomas, is more of a critic and an activist who is concerned about, you know, possible unintended side effects of this sort of tampering with nature.
Well, we'll definitely have to have you back on after the conference. Maybe sometime we can get some time from you. That'd be awesome. Well, yeah. Tell me, you've been doing some you've been doing some speaker training for scientists. Tell me a little bit about that. What does that entail? What's involved with? Are you teaching scientists how to communicate what they're doing? What's going on with that?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. It came from I was initially contacted last year by the National Research Council of Canada, and asked if I'd do such a thing, and I went to Ottawa and did some and led some workshops that were just about basic communication skills, really. But since they were all specifically scientists and had a sort of specialized type of topic that they would probably would speak on, it was like a dozen scientists of a variety of disciplines. And I guess I was able to hang with that and understand what they do and then give them my feedback and give them, well, I put together a program and we had some, like a full day workshop, and I did that a couple times, and, I'm doing it for a few other people here. In fact, at AAAS is a big science conference coming up, this month. And I'm going to be actually a little different. I was actually asked to lead a workshop that has to do with humor, using humor in science communication. And the idea of teaching scientists to be funny is a little different and maybe a little more frightening.
You know, I've got this mental picture of you as like Will Smith coaching, you know, Kevin James, you know, how to pick up the woman of his dreams. You know, sometimes you might have a lot of work depending on the scientist, I guess, that you're trying to teach. You know.
But I would say, you know, there's always that stereotype of scientists being, whether it's antisocial or dull or bookish, which, you know, okay, obviously bookish might be a word that scientists can be fairly applied. But, you know, you may know this, but in my experience, most of the scientists I've met, I think of scientists as people that have devoted their lives to studying just the world and pursuing their curiosity. And not only as a career, but as what they've dedicated their life to. And I think that to maintain the childlike wonder that gets beaten out of most people, I think that in my experience, they are funny and interesting and just that. They've maintained the childlike wonder with the world and even turned it into a career.
Absolutely. I've recently finished a biography of Richard Feynman, and he strikes me as a party animal. Basically, when he wasn't busy with science, he was just pretty much a character. And I would suspect you find that probably just as often as you find the stereotypical social, you know, backward kind of scientist. And
he's definitely an exceptional guy. But wow, what a character. And he's pretty fun to read. And anyone who hasn't seen him, I'd recommend just looking him up on YouTube, because he's very entertaining to watch.
Absolutely. Well, tell us a little bit about the videos you've done for Time Magazine. Have you are those available on YouTube or at Time Magazine's website? How do we if we want to catch some of those, how do we do it?
Well, they're on time.com and under the video section. And if you search for my name there, you can find it, Brian Mallow, MALOW1L. You can find most of them pretty easily by going to my site, sciencecomedian.com, and looking under videos there. And they are, I've gotten into the habit of sort of saying they're mildly humorous, because they're not quite like my stand-up for the most part, although there's a time travel one that I think is pretty funny. That's basically asks if time travel is scientifically possible and takes a humorous look at the issue. And but actually some of them are sort of straight. I did one about the Herschel Space Observatory, and one about exotic insects, and an organization here, SaveNature.org, that brings really cool exotic insects into classrooms for kids. It's called the Insect Discovery Lab. And they also raise money to protect habitats, to raise awareness and raise money to protect habitats where we're losing this kind of biodiversity. But I did a piece last year on Elon Musk, SpaceX.
Yeah.
So the thing is, I love science so that some of them don't have to be comedy. A couple of them are sort of a little straighter than that. There was one piece on Pandora, and I interviewed Tim Westerman, the founder of Pandora, you know, the internet radio company. And some of these pieces are just sort of, I just think they're interesting. And some of them are a little funnier. I did a piece on They Might Be Giants that was pretty fun last year.
Yeah. Well, that's the freedom you have as a science comedian. That, you know, sometimes you're a little heavier weight on the science part, and the other time on the funny, you know. So you can kind of pick and choose, you know.
Right.
You got some freedom.
I still think, yeah, I'm a fan of science, and I just think it's cool. So if I can make that, sometimes I'm okay with that. But if I can make it funny, well, then we'll go that way with it.
That's awesome. Well, tell me, you know, things are happening so fast. I mean, I find it difficult as a person who tries to stay on top of the developments of science. You know, I find it difficult because I'll learn about something that's like earth-shattering like a month and a half after it's announced. You know, I mean, and I'm a guy that's trying to keep up. So I guess my question to you is, what science developments, you know, have you heard about recently that have you excited, or maybe even better, have your audience excited? You know, what things are going on that, you know, really stick out in your head as important these days?
As important? I don't know. I've always, you know, I think I'm like you in that, especially if maybe it would help if we specialized in one area, but if you try to keep up with everything, it's just unbelievable how much is every day. It's overwhelming how much science news is out there. So in this, and, you know, actually you kind of hit on something, that the theme of the conference I'm going to, it has a title, Here Be Dragons, like they used to write on old maps, where there were places where there were parts that there were territories that were not mapped yet, and they sometimes said, here be dragons. And that's kind of what this conference is about. It's about moving into territories for which we don't have maps. It's about the fact that what you just said, that science moves ahead so fast that it's hard to keep up with it. And that's the issue actually being explored. It's actually a little broader than just synthetic biology. It's just in general, how do you keep up with science when it comes to things that maybe need to be regulated or something? So I don't know, but in astronomy, you know what? One thing that's really cool is solar sails, and the fact that we've had some experiments, and so have the Japanese, in solar sail like spacecraft. I'm fascinated with the idea of space. The discovery of extrasolar planets, and that's not brand new, and it's been going on for years now. And we've discovered something that wasn't true when we were kids, is that now we have this knowledge that we have identified hundreds of planets around other stars, and that tells us a lot about the likelihood of planets evolving around stars. And then the better our techniques get, and the smaller the planets that we're able to detect, will give us some insight into how rare a planet like Earth is. And that's towards this figuring out how rare life might be in this universe.
Are we the one that, you know, in the movie Contact, it was said that, well, it sure would be a lot of wasted space if that's the case, but,
yeah,
you know, we just don't, fact is, we just don't know. And you're right. Just recently, we've heard about you know, the discovery of a rocky planet that's not not too terribly much bigger than the Earth. And so, you know, and that's to find a planet's like that's, you know, close to the Earth in size around around another star. That's kind of a big deal. So that's. And it seems like those discoveries are coming faster all the time. The number of exoplanets, you check the list every month or two, and it just keeps going up and up and up. So that's exciting, isn't it?
Yeah, it's so cool. I always think how amazing it is that how much we've learned about the universe just by studying the light that falls down upon the Earth from all directions. And being able to tease out all this really cool information from all these different parts of the spectrum, shining down on us all the time. It's information. And just the fact that we figured that out, that you could tease out that kind of information from just light that has been falling from billions of years even. Yeah.
That's incredible, isn't it?
It is.
That's awesome. Well, the date that you got coming up is the San Francisco Punchline Comedy Club. It's Wednesday, February the 9th. If some of our listeners are in the San Francisco area, they want to swing by and hear you. What time are you going to be up there?
That's an 8 o'clock show, and you can contact the Punchline Comedy Club here in San Francisco. I suppose I could even tell you the phone number is 415-397-4337. As I'm looking right now at a little flyer, the show is called Spontaneous Emissions, an evening of science humor.
That's a great one. I can imagine what that could possibly be about. I have a possible idea there. That's great. That's great.
Yeah, you know, a long time ago I'd written this line that I was in an excited state and I had a spontaneous emission.
I hate it when that happens on a date. I really do. Well, anyway, Brian, it's been a pleasure talking with you today, and I hope to have you again on Fast Forward Radio very soon.
Thank you very much, and good luck.
Okay, thank you. Good luck to you. Break a leg. All right, that was fun getting caught up with Brian.
He's a fun, interesting guy. He's got interesting perspectives on the world, which is an important part of being a comedian, I think, is having that kind of slightly skewed way of looking at things. But tonight we didn't really get funny Brian. That was a more serious Brian than we've spoken to previously.
You know, he's an onion. He's got many layers. We'll get him back on when and hear the funny Brian probably some other night. So, anyway,
yeah, absolutely. We're open to both kinds of Brian on this program, seeing as you mentioned, Stephen. We also try to weave in and out of being entertaining and talking about these serious issues, and that's a tricky course to navigate sometimes. So actually, as he was talking about that, I'm trying to think of which is scarier, the genetically modified mosquitoes, which I'm frankly not all that scared of, because it sounds like what's the real possibility here is that mosquitoes go extinct might be the absolute downside.
it's sort of like fire ants going extinct, you know, boo-hoo,
yeah. Yeah, you know, that probably would just lead to the absolute, you know, I mean, it would the complete disintegration of the whole biosphere somehow, right, a connection that we don't see right now. But to think, what if there's something we could do without? Surely it's mosquitoes, right? It probably would be a terrible catastrophe somehow. But anyway, mosquito control, that's serious business, particularly in an age that doesn't use DDT, and we're not going to go down that road. But when you don't have the proven kind of most effective pesticide available, you start thinking of, well, what other ways we can get rid of these? Because the nets and some of those other remedies they suggest really don't work very well. And people get malaria, people get dengue. It's a, you know, it's a really serious problem. You don't want your population dying of dengue fever. What do you do? Well, you know, let's tweak the mosquito's genetic code a little bit and see, you know, roll the dice on that one, see what happens. It'd be interesting to see how that pans out.
I want to make sure I understand exactly what they're doing. So they're releasing sterile male mosquitoes. I assume the whole point of
No, they're not. They're not. These are not sterile. This is interesting. Here's the trick. Here's the catcher, okay? These are fertile male mosquitoes who produce sterile offspring.
Okay. All right. So that, they're just one generation away from, you know, these mosquitoes spend all their time caring for young that can't have young themselves, I guess. And
yeah,
so,
here's what you want. You want to unleash a population of super frisky, right, super aggressive, big, muscular mosquitoes with this profile, right, because they're going to go find all the females. They're going to mate with the females, and the females will then produce all this next generation of sterile mosquitoes. So that's it, right? They're not going to be able to reproduce. So you can dramatically cut the population of mosquitoes, assuming that this population of males that produce sterile offspring is, you know, sufficiently effective at getting their profile out into the gene pool.
These are mosquitoes that, have abs and are especially witty.
Exactly,
they have great pickup lines, you know.
Yeah, these mosquitoes are driving the nice car if they're wearing the good clothes. That's what we're saying. We want them to work. Because it does appear that it has a safety built in, which is it's a one generation shot. If the mosquito that produces sterile offspring doesn't succeed before he dies, that's gone. Right, that whole tendency to produce sterile offspring is out of the gene pool. So I don't know. It would be interesting to see how that pans out. But anyway, what I was going to say was I'm not sure which is scarier, the thought of the killer mosquitoes, the thought of the genetically modified mosquitoes, or the thought of trying to teach scientists how to be funny.
Yeah.
Wow.
I think it depends entirely on the scientist. You know, you're going to have some scientists that, are kind of like the Mr. Spocks that are going to find, humor. I just don't understand humor, and there are a few Sheldons out there,
indeed. Although, actually, maybe the emphasis shouldn't be on the word science. I mean, how could you teach anyone how to be funny? Right? I mean, it seems like that feels like one of those things that's just almost innate, right? Either you got it or
you got it. You don't. Yeah. Oh well.
I almost have it, Stephen. That's why we keep pushing
it. We almost have. We're almost there. Well, I think maybe it comes down to maybe he's helping them in saying that, well, these aspects of your work not interesting to the general public. This one aspect over here of your work, you need to spend more time on that because the average person is going to be a lot more interested in learning about your genetically altered, super sexy mosquitoes. Than the ins and outs of genetic coding. Maybe you can just tell them what's more interesting to the populace at large.
The mission of teaching people to be better speakers, I think, is a great idea, and I think that applies well to scientists. It's an excellent idea to help scientists convey their ideas better. I think technical people generally need to be better at communicating verbally. Some of them are excellent writers. But I mean, many are excellent writers, but there is a problem, I think, with technical folks, scientists and engineers, often in interpersonal skills and understanding how to communicate verbally. So I think teaching those skills is a great idea, and that is teachable stuff. It just when you think you're going to teach people how to be funny, man, that is really raising the bar. I think that's raising the bar to dangerous levels. Well, it's great that he mentioned the mosquito thing because that was actually one of the additional stories that I was going to bring up tonight in our potpourri. And then you brought up one of the others. So this is just everything is just dovetailing so wonderfully. You talked about the rocky planet, and I actually wanted to point out the story I found over on physorg.com the headline was NASA spots 54 potentially life-friendly planets. You know, to the point where, I mean, and we've talked about this before on Strange New Worlds a few months ago and related shows that we've done in the past, almost to the point where we're jaded, right, where you say, oh, 54 new planets, no big deal. So it's four life-like planets. Actually, that is a pretty darn big deal when you think that it was huge news when there was one found, and now they're talking about dozens of them out there. Here's how the story starts. It says, in just a year of peering out at a small slice of the galaxy, the Kepler telescope has spotted 1,235 possible planets outside our solar system. Amazingly, 54 of them are seemingly in the zone that could be hospitable to life. That is, not too hot or too cold, says the Kepler chief scientist William Buraki. So, this telescope's been up and running for about a year. It's found potentially 1,235 new planets. That is to say, it's found 1,235 anomalies consistent with the presence of planets. One thing that has to happen is they have to do further investigation and actually determine whether there's a planet there or not. But Mr. Buraki estimates that 80% of them eventually will be verified. And at least one of the astronomers says in the story believes Kepler could be at 90% accurate. So where does that put us, 80 to 90% accuracy on that? That's going to be over 1,000 anyway, right?
Right. And if we got 80 or 90% accuracy on the Goldilocks zone of the planets, what is that? That's got to be about 30 planets, huh? So
yeah, exactly. Yeah, 30 potentially life-supporting planets. And it's very interesting what they're finding. Among other things, they're finding that while most planets that they discover are larger than Earth, and that's not at all surprising because they're looking for these gravitational blips that are much easier to spot from larger planets than smaller planets, while the planets they're discovering are all, actually I think consistently all larger than Earth, Jupiter is bigger than most of what they're finding. So, you know, they have found a few really super enormous ones, and among the first planets, exoplanets that were ever discovered, they were bigger than Jupiter. But when you start gathering a bigger sample size and you start actually starting to get a feel for what the galaxy looks like planet-wise, you see that Earth may be a very tiny planet, and Jupiter is apparently a very large planet. So we've got, and of course, we've got smaller planets than Earth in our solar system, going down to Mercury, if you don't count Pluto as a planet, which we're not supposed to. So we apparently have a pretty good range of planet size in our solar system, one of the kind of side lessons we're learning.
Well, that's interesting. And I've heard before how important Jupiter is for our planet. Jupiter apparently sucks up a lot of comets and a lot of stray things that could be, you know, life enders for Earth. And you know, because it's so big, you know, things end up hitting Jupiter instead of Earth.
Jupiter's gravity well is like almost like a defense field for Earth.
Exactly. And so it's so huge that anything that's coming from the outer solar system into the inner solar system is going to be
heading towards the sun. Yeah, if it's going to get diverted towards anywhere, it'll probably be Jupiter. That's
right. We've actually seen Jupiter being hit by pretty big things, and so
yeah,
we've seen that in action. So it could be that one of the reasons that Earth turns out to be such a uniquely blessed planet life-wise is the fact that we have such a uniquely giant gas giant out there, kind of, you know, running interference for us.
Just more of the lucky coincidence that is our existence here on this planet.
Yeah, the anthropic principle in work.
I'm sorry.
I was just saying that the anthropic principle in action.
Exactly. Jupiter's size is just another bit of evidence for the strong anthropic principle. Well, I had that, and then I had one other. I see we're getting close on our time.
Yeah.
Which is, I don't know if you saw this story, but we've talked about invisibility cloaks in the past. And so this headline, invisibility cloak hides 3D objects from the naked eye. What's exciting about this latest iteration of it is it's significantly bigger than the ones that they have built before. And this new one can actually hide three-dimensional objects against red and green lasers and ordinary white light. So
right.
We're still a long way from the Harry Potter cloak or the cloaking device in Star Trek, but we're getting closer. Now, this one has been demonstrated on a space on an object about 3/4 of an inch, about 2 centimeters wide. So, we're still not talking about you can hide a tank with it. But in principle, if you can hide a 3D object that's 3/4 of an inch across, you can hide a 3D object that is 60 feet across. The proof of concept is there. And it's just a matter of time before this technology starts being implemented. I'm going to guess initially with military applications. It seems to me this would be, the military invented the idea of camouflage, as far as I know, and have perfected it over the last probably century or so. This is like the ultimate camouflage. It seems to me that if anyone is hotly pursuing this technology, it would be the military.
Yeah, what we want is, camouflage like in the movie Predator, right?
Yeah.
Where you see right through these things. Well, and I would guess, I bet you, this is, again, this is just me throwing out hazarding a complete and utter guess, but I'll bet you it would be easier to implement this for a tank than it would be for something much smaller like a soldier. A tank can carry big, heavy equipment. And if big, heavy equipment is needed to implement a cloak, then a tank can handle it. Whereas if you need a 100-pound pack worth of stuff, to cloak a soldier, that wouldn't really be, it wouldn't really work out so well. So
you've just explained why on Star Trek the ships had cloaking devices, but there were no handheld individual invisibility devices.
Yeah, but I always wondered why the Federation agreed to no cloaking devices when their enemies had it. I thought that was a suicidal high-mindedness of them. But anyway, don't get me started on that.
Well, at least in the original series with Kirk. It was simply a matter of the fact that the Romulans had it and nobody else had it. It was a technological advantage. I think it was probably in the Next Generation when they, that sounds more like a Picard thing. It sounds more like the Picard generation of Star Trek to take this. Oh, we wouldn't use one of those, even if they were doing it. Yeah, that's
dumb.
Maybe not a great way to go if you're, shooting lasers at each other. Anyhow, I think we're very close to our time. Unless you had one more topic you wanted to throw out, we should probably switch over to the music.
I think we should go ahead and hit the music tonight. The music tonight is from Subplot A. They're the same guys who brought us Every Man and Pluto Rocks. But tonight, the song is Must Sell Screenplay.
Must Sell Screenplay. All right. Well, we'll look forward to listening to that. Thanks for putting that together, Steven. And thanks to everyone who has listened. Thanks for being part of Fast Forward Radio. We'll be back on with our World Transformed wrap-up archive show on Saturday, another dip into the archives next Monday, and back on live again next Wednesday night. Hope you'll be able to join us for all those programs. And until next time, live to see it.
Mr. Spielberg, it's a drama you can't resist. It's Jaws meets Chandler's List. Don't be pissed, I got your unlisted number. It's got tons of product placements. It'll kill in foreign markets, 'cause the narrator's the shark. Oh, and I'll let you give the acceptance speech.
What do you say, Stevie? Steve? Hello?
Please, Mr. Tarantino, I'm sure your writer's block's a rumor. I've got Pulp Fiction with some humor, a Velcro bodysuit for Uma. The soundtrack's esoteric, and the gore is metaphoric. The purple blood is an homage to Barney. We can split the film and double our gross. Exactly, gratuitous profanity.
Hello?
Must sell screenplay. I'm a Hollywood star trapped in the body of an ordinary guy. It'll be better than all the crap. take high six figures against 1.9. Please, Mr. Shama Lama Lama Lama, you'll love my supernatural thriller. It's Sixth Sense meets Natural Born Killers. I got your number from Ben Stiller. It's got a killer act 3 twist. Bruce Willis realizes he's a giraffe. Did I say Stiller? I meant Owen Wilson. Oh, and I'll let you do a cameo. Did I mention the giraffe is dead? Hello? Please, Mr. Scorsese, think Sideways meets Casino. A midlife road trip to Reno, where Pacino ices De Niro's Pino. Only instead of wine, it's sushi. And the mobsters roll the lobsters. It's an offer you can't refuse. Get it? Get it? What do you mean? Didn't you do Godfather? Hello? Hello? Must sell screenplay. I'm a Hollywood star trapped in the body of an ordinary guy. It'll be better than all the crap that's out there now. No offense. It's a steal at mid six against 1.5. Do you feel lucky, Mr. Eastwood? It's Unforgiven meets Bollywood. I saw you sipping a chai latte in Westwood with Deepak Chopra and Elijah something. A love triangle with no kissing. Your lips sink through the chuck wagons. Oh, and maybe one of you has a chimp or a hobbit or a Wookiee. Yeah. Go ahead. Make my samosa. Hello? Please, Mr. Nolan, it's Monty Python meets Memento. The chronology is mental, and the comedy is dental. I mean, British. Accents are outrageous. The amnesia is contagious. The knights laugh at the same joke over and over. Oh, John Cleese has a tattoo of the Holy Grail on his butt. Only Grail spelled backwards. Lierg. Sell screenplay. I'm a Hollywood star trapped in the body of an ordinary guy. It'll be better than all the crap that's out there now. You know what I mean. It's yours for low six against 0.9. Please, Mr. Reiner. It's a tragic romantic mock-you fantasy. It's Sophie's Choice meets Harry meets Sally. It's funny and deep, and I see Meryl Streep faking an orgasm in a castle, kind of a Spinal Tap-ish Princess Bride. She and Billy Crystal can't have a child because she discovers she's inconceivable. What do you mean you do not think it means what I think it means? Hello? Must sell screenplay. I'm a Hollywood star trapped in the body of an ordinary guy. It's better than all the crap that's out there now. Nothing personal. I'll take back end points because what I really want to do is direct. Oh, my self screenplay. I'm a Hollywood superstar trapped in the body of an ordinary guy. My self screenplay. Or maybe sell a song about it. Please, Mr. Eno, I got your number from the Edge.